Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're bringing you some listener mail today. Now, we just did an episode of Halloween-related listener mail, stuff for our October episodes on All Things Monstrous. But there was a ton of great listener mail that I would say fell in the crack, maybe between the coffin and the hard place, got wedged in there, and it's too good to pass by, so we're bringing you a second helping. This is going to be listener mail. A lot of it, I think, was from September, some from more recently. So we hope you enjoy.
That's right. There's a lot of great stuff in here, and we wanted to do right. We wanted to pay off our debts here, listener mail related, before we move on into some more exciting content that'll take us through the holidays and ultimately into a new decade. As always, Carney, our mailbot, is here to help us. I was telling Carney about my own philosophy regarding the holidays moving forward, and then I'm going to lean into the holidays. Mm-hmm. I'm going to embrace the holidays. And so Carney's doing the same thing. He's cooking nonstop, though. He's researching recipes for Thanksgiving dishes, and he is attempting to replicate food that humans can safely eat.
He just presented me a dish of delicious braised Pop-Tarts that I can't wait to tuck into.
It is technically food. You cannot deny it.
All right. Should we look at this first piece of mail? This comes from our listener, Jordan, regarding the interview you did with Mark Mandica about, among many things, copperheads, snapping turtles, and all that.
That's right. You were traveling, so I had Mark come into the studio when we chatted. And yeah, this is what Jordan had to say. Quote, I was recently listening to your September interview with Mark Mandinka on animal conservation and vilified reptiles and thought I would share my personal experience being bitten by a copperhead snake. This being said, I have always loved snakes, and the experience has not left me with any hatred of the reptiles or species themselves.
That's very big of you, Jordan.
5 years ago, I was bitten on the foot by a baby copperhead snake in North Carolina. As you may know, baby venomous snakes are often considered more dangerous due to their lack of venom output control. I wasn't aware of the snake's presence at the time, and the bite marks were discovered by the ER, but the pain felt similar to that of an insect sting. Following the bite itself, my vision nearly immediately went yellow as I temporarily lost the ability to see other colors. About 10 seconds after, my muscles collapsed to the forest floor, and I had to drag myself out of the woods to a nearby park bench as I was too weak to stand. I didn't end up needing anti-venom, but I was connected to 3 IV machines and kept in the hospital overnight as my foot was extremely swollen and blue in color. I was confined to a wheelchair and crutches for multiple months after with my swollen foot. So I definitely felt side effects of the copperhead venoms. Mild or not in comparison to other venoms, I would not wish to relieve the experience. Although it is a much better story than any encounter I've had with a skug. I love Stuff to Blow Your Mind and Invention. And I hope you enjoyed hearing what happened to someone that was actually bitten by a copperhead snake.
That's a great story, Jordan. I don't know if I'd ever heard about the vision going yellow before. That's a very interesting effect.
Right. Likewise, I either didn't know or had forgotten about the young snakes and venom control, venom output control. That's interesting as well. And yeah, it's just nice to have a firsthand account of the power of a snake's venom. I have never been bitten by a snake, so I can't relate. I've been stung by wasps, but that's it.
All right. Next, we've got a couple of emails going way back to our episodes about fatbergs, of course, the dragons, the soap dragons that grow in our sewers when we flush wet wipes like we shouldn't. Don't wash oil and grease down the sink. Don't flush wet wipes, folks. And this comes from an anonymous listener, one who wished to remain anonymous. They say, "Hi, Robert and Joe, and good stuff to blow your mind, people." So I guess that concerns you too, Seth. "First off, you guys are truly of the finest podcasters, communicators, progressive thinkers, bastions of curiosity that I've encountered in podcast land. Thank you sincerely for your podcast and other endeavors." Well, you're far too kind. Now, I present to you a real-life fatberg superhero. We were asking about this in our fatberg episodes. I think the idea we came up with, though, was fatberg cop, right?
Yes.
But the listener here says, "It is the now-retired Grease Avenger from the City of Los Angeles Bureau of Sanitation. The Grease Avenger was created by someone named Adil Hujakhalil to promote awareness of the problems resulting in sewers from FOG, or fog, fats, oil, and grease. This, at the time, division manager would dress up in his super suit and appear at functions to promote the messaging. Now that Mr. Hujakhalil has progressed in his career to manage a different bureau, the Grease Avenger has been retired, and almost all links to the story and images have been plucked from the web. A little nugget of fatberg gold remains, however. See the screenshot and link below. This is the only remaining image I could find of Mr. Hujakhalil in his super suit. The story unfolds below in this obscure University of Houston publication. You'll see why when you read the story. Although his superhero days are likely entirely behind him, Adil remains a much beloved and effective visionary leader and is now general manager of the City of Los Angeles Bureau of Street Services. Although sewers and subterranean systems rarely hold the attention of the public, those of us who design and construct and maintain and operate this infrastructure know that we keep the poo beast at bay. All you need to remember, my friends, is that the sun shall rise tomorrow, thanks in part to people like Adil Hujakhalil."
I'm so glad we've come back to this particular email, because I was delighted that there was a real-life fatberg cop.
"But can you believe it? There's more. In my early days as a newly minted civil engineer in British Columbia, I needed to install flow gauges in the sewers of a remote coastal community. Accurately gauging sewer flows is not trivial. It's fraught with all the perils you can imagine, plus complications that can arise from hydraulics and dynamic conditions. Anyway, to install the most accurate type of flow gauge, which is a metal band with a sensor at the bottom of it, one must physically install the band inside the sewer pipe. You must go down a manhole, or maintenance hole, to use the more inclusive term, and reach into the sewer pipe by hand, often while it's flowing, and install. We popped a maintenance hole cover to begin installation, only to find that the walls and everything inside were coated in an inch or so thick layer of white, softish, greasy goo. The diet of this remote community, you see, features a delicacy, ulican grease. For the referenced website, quote, beginning around the end of February, they started to fish vast quantities of ulican, a small and very oily member of the smelt family. Ulekin was not usually eaten as a fish meat. The vast majority of the catch was rendered for its edible grease, which could be stored for many months. They boiled the ulekin, that's O-O-L-I-C-H-A-N, if I'm pronouncing that wrong, in large cedar-bent boxes until the grease separated and rose to the top. They then skimmed the grease and poured it into other boxes to store it for trade with other tribes or eating throughout the year. The grease is prominent in all aspects of life in the local indigenous culture, so it was not surprising to see it represented with such gusto in the sewers, which quite literally link the entire community. We couldn't safely climb inside with all that grease, so we got fire hoses and nozzles and other various implementia to clean out the manholes and pipes sufficiently to let us do our work. Not wanting to ruin our boots and clothing, and generally stay as poo-free as possible, we donned rain gear, heavy gloves, and bags that we duct tape liberally to, you guessed it, a supersuit.
Yeah.
The only record that remains is a coffee mug that my workmates at the time had made for me from a project photo that my colleague took. See attached. I never thought this photo might one day be relevant or shareable in any way. I present my elevated persona, Sewer Man. Remember, flush not thine wipes of wetness, for nothing good therefrom shall come.
Oh, wow. That was a great listener email that just got better and better.
Yeah. It had everything. It had a Fatberg cop from the real world.
Mm-hmm.
It had a battle with a unique type of sewer grease. I mean,
right. This
is great.
We learned a little bit about other cultures. Yeah, it's pretty great, all in all. And it's not the only bit of Fatberg listener mail that we have to read for you. This next one comes to us from Maurice, titled Fatbergs from Outer Space. They write, I'm a longtime fan of Stuff to Blow Your Mind and listen to the show not just to learn about weird and noteworthy things, but also to gain inspiration for my own creative efforts. I write horror, science fiction, and fantasy stories, but I also write my own modules for the RPG games I run. After listening to the recent Fatberg episode, I became disgustingly fascinated and knew I had to design a grossed-out module for my Starfinder game, a science fantasy game by Piazzo, I believe it is. This is the company that makes Pathfinder. It's my understanding that Starfinder is like the sci-fi sub-brand or you know, parallel brand to Pathfinder.
I don't know a thing about it.
Pathfinder, more traditional, like D&D style.
Okay.
And there's a more complicated history there as well. But anyway, that's what they're talking about here. Talking about setting this up as a side mission. Quote, the setup is on a space station, which uses magic to run much of its life support in conjunction with more science-based methods. A Fatberg has been generated on board in the water system, bordering too close to the magical subsystems, and has gained a kind of sentience. And the players have to find a way to defeat it and its minions before it threatens the station on the whole. Our quest against the Fatberg starts tonight. I really can't thank you enough for this thoroughly nauseating but immensely interesting topic. As a thank you, I've included a few stat blocks for this module, which I have custom created and included here, complete with ecology and tactical notes. Sorry for the formatting. I use several platforms to create content, and sometimes I have to use lower quality JPEGs for output. Keep the great content coming, Maurice.
Now, I don't know anything about stat sheets or designing monsters, but Robert, if you have any thoughts.
Oh, no, it looked pretty good. You know me, I can't resist looking at at stats for monsters. And yeah, this looks like a really fun encounter. I also like the idea of the magic and the science being mingled together on the spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've encountered that before, but it makes sense, right? If you're going to power a starship, you don't want to depend exclusively on magic. You need to have at least a science backup in place.
Right. I would guess that magic is more fickle and fleeting and finicky, and you got to have something, a reliable generator running in the background.
Right. And then, science can only do so much. Something's got to make the artificial gravity work. So might as well turn to pure magic for that.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more.
All right, we're back.
All right, so we did an episode a while back about school dreams, the dreams where people are returned to high school or college, and we addressed why these dreams are so common, why they so often invoke anxiety, why they're so common in people who have been out of school for many years. And quite a few listeners got in touch about these. I would say this is one of the most email-generating episodes we've done in a while.
Yeah, and certainly we're not going to read them all on the show, but I will say that just the sheer volume of emails did speak to the near-universal aspects of this sort of dream.
Mm-hmm. Though a couple of people let us know that they didn't have school mm-hmm. dreams. They usually had some kind of equivalent that was based on some other part of their lives. A lot of people got in touch answering Robert's question about whether people who were in the military had military yep. dreams, and quite a few people did. You know, they would have dreams of not being able to like get their uniform right or not being able to figure out where they're supposed to go and things yeah. like that. So to read a couple of the ones we got in response to the school dreams episode, this first one comes from Brendan. Brendan says, "Hey guys, I'm an avid listener of the show and often feel compelled to write in, but by the time I'm around my computer, the desire has been absorbed by the day-to-day duties of my life. However, this time I happen to be in front of my computer as I finished one of your recent episodes on school dreams. I cannot recall ever having dreams of either high school or college, though I attended both. However, I went to community college later in my 20s and placed little personal value on my high school experience. I went directly into the workforce from high school, waiting tables, and later tending bar. I do somewhat regularly have dreams of showing up late for shifts and not wearing clothes in the restaurant, etc., in spite of having transitioned out of this type of work some years ago. I'm now an arborist. I have a hard time imagining two more divergent careers. I think it was Joe who questioned why school would be the metaphor a brain might select for dealing with present personal problems." Remember, this is following up from a number of people commenting on this phenomenon who said that they thought that school dreams were really about whatever present challenges people were facing, and that maybe the brain just selected school as a kind of template or metaphor for working out those problems in the dream. Brendan continues, "I think that the reminiscence bump provides a possible answer couched in one of the other statements you made, that the period of life in which your so-called teenage brain is making vivid memories that help one to identify with self, you're also creating an extremely personalized metaphor that could be adaptable in motivating action when one is faced with a problem that has no clear solution. By providing a feeling of reconnection to the basic self lost to time, similar to how people have used tarot, astrology, and other randomly accessed organized stimuli to give their life direction, school just happens to be a near universal experience for people of that age in modern culture and often referred to as where we, quote, figure out who we are. I think I would be most interested in hearing data and accounts of hunter-gatherer, early pastoral, or other non-industrial cultures and their school dream equivalents. Anyways, I hope this wasn't too long-winded and helps shed some light on the experience of those who didn't attend college at that formative period of life. Thank you also for indulging my armchair philosophical hypothesis. I love the show and the sounds of your voices. Have a great day, and I look forward to hearing your next topic." Well, thanks a lot, Brendan.
Yeah, that was some interesting insight into the topic for sure.
I totally echo. I mean, if you're like a dream researcher out there, I would like to see if people who don't really have anything equivalent to like the standard, you know, United States kind of school experience, if people in hunter-gatherer societies or something report different patterns of dreams that are in any way analogous to school dreams.
Yeah, that would be something interesting to cover. All right, here's another dream email. This one comes to us from Sammy. "Hey guys, just started listening to the episode called School Dreams, and wow, did I relate to this. One of my only nightmares is forgetting I had a class and realizing it at the end of the semester. I know this isn't school related, but my most common nightmare is actually being a waitress and forgetting one of my tables. I was a waitress about 7 years ago for 2 years. Those have to be related, right? I'd be curious to know if you guys have these kinds of dreams about your jobs. All the best, Sammy." P.S. from follow-up email, "Sorry, I kept listening and realized I should give you some context on my education. I went straight from high school to university for an engineering degree, where during my second and third year, I was a waitress. All of my school nightmares were forgetting university classes, but not high school. Honestly, I think this is probably because up until university, I had no difficulty in school, but engineering was quite hard. Thanks." Well, let's see. Well, that first question about dreams about jobs and job stress, I used to. So I worked in newspapers for a while before I ended up working for How Stuff Works and getting into podcasting and so forth. And I would do I would increasingly just do pagination, so like laying out pages of the newspaper in a program like InDesign.
You're the kerning master.
Yeah, yeah, all that fun stuff. I mean, and it was fun. I enjoyed it, but it was also. It was also stressful because you had to get everything to a fine point or as fine a point as possible, having to edit the content, edit the headlines, and then it goes to the press and then that's it, you know, and you just hope that you got everything. And so I would – for years after I had left that job and that profession, I would still have dreams in which I was concerned about the layout of the front page of the newspaper, and then somehow – The bed that I was sleeping in was the front page of the newspaper, and the pillows were different modules on the front page, like, you know, a headline or a text box or an image box or a caption or an illustrative piece. And I had to be careful not to move because if I physically moved my body, I might disrupt the various elements of the front page of the newspaper.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Finally went away, thankfully.
I have school dreams a lot, but I also have job dreams all the time. I've had job dreams about like when I was I've worked in restaurants and grocery stores and stuff. I had server dreams, like lots of stuff about like forgetting about tables and stuff. It's actually somewhat equivalent to the school dreams, like a big table that I forgot I had and I'd been neglecting them all night. Now they're mad and that kind of thing. I'd have dreams about like losing track of dairy products. when I worked in a grocery store, I was one of the main things I had to do was like keep stock of the dairy aisle and move stuff up from the cooler in the back out to the shelves and stuff like that. And so it involved a lot of management of inventory by date. And so I'd have dreams where like I couldn't read the dates and couldn't understand what needed to be out there, and then I'd lose things, and everything always had to be kept cold. So anyway, that's probably very boring. Sorry.
But this is interesting too, because this touches on something that we, I think, discussed recently on the show, and that's the reading in dreams.
Yeah.
So you were having the experience where you're just having a lot of trouble reading these numbers, but not to the point where you're like, oh, I must be in a dream I can't read.
I don't think the problem was that I couldn't read. It was more like there's a lot of – the dream had a – I remember not being able to keep track of information.
Okay. Dream. Well, that also lines up with it right there. Yeah. Like the analytical brain is not fully engaged enough to really keep track of things or to question the authenticity.
Yeah. I think working memory and critical reasoning are somewhat limited in the dream world. But also I have tons of anxiety dreams about like the kind of job I have now. Again, not very hard to figure out what they might be. It's like I dream that I released a podcast on a subject only to find out after we already published it that everything I said was grossly inaccurate. And people are like, how could you get all this stuff wrong? And I'm like, oh, no. And yeah.
It's weird because I have some of those same waking anxieties, you know, and I have some of the same job stresses that you do because we pretty much have the same job. And yet I never have dreams about them. Huh. I never do. Instead, I have the school dream.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, I will say I have the school dream way more than I have job dreams, like way more than I have dreams about the current job I have. I think the way I'd put it is I have had job dreams like that. I still have the school dream on a regular basis.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. That lines up with me. Like I had the job dreams for a while. They outlasted the job, but then they went away. All right. So I want to read one, maybe two of the emails concerning, you know, these school dreams about the military or from people who served in the military. This one comes to us from Dan. Dan writes, I joined the Army 1 week after graduating high school. I didn't take school seriously and do not recall any school-related dreams today. However, after serving in the Persian Gulf War, my dreams were consumed with a persistent vision. In this dream, I repeatedly had, I was disposing of an anonymous human being wrapped in a rug, tossed into a dumpster.
Oh, horrible.
The dream was so real, I began to question its authenticity. Was it part of my reality? I reeled for months about it. As time passed, so did the dream. I used my GI Bill to attend college in upstate New York. Along the way, my dreams began to stress and fret about school and classes I'd forgotten to attend. This dream also became so visceral that I began to check my schedule to ensure my reality was not what my dreams would have me believe. Love the episode. Love what you guys do. Keep up the great work. Dan.
Okay, so this is multiple interesting permutations. So saying no dreams about school when he was in school, and then was in the military and served in combat and had persistent dreams, but maybe not necessarily directly about the military, but so much like a, I don't know, some kind of related persistent nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely, you know, not to serve as dream interpreter here, but it definitely seems tied to the like the stress of dealing, you know, with life in a combat zone.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the thing about not having dreams about high school, that lines up with a lot of, I think, a lot of what people have said, you know, where it's definitely that post-high school period of life that that dictates the dream content.
Well, yeah, that seems like one of the main variants, like either it's mostly college or mostly high school or whatever else you were doing at that time or some other thing, other part of the life that people view. We did hear from a lot of people saying it was like these self-defining years that really seemed to form their persistent like frustration, anxiety, or problem-solving dreams.
We asked specifically at one point about homeschooling, I think.
Yeah, and we heard from several people who were homeschooled who did have related dreams.
Right. But here's one from Heather, who also served in the military. So we get like a double in this one. Heather writes, I have had dreams about elementary school mostly, and I am usually late or still in PJs and everyone is mocking me. I was homeschooled in middle school and I never dream about that. I never dream of public high school or college either. I was also in the military, and while I was in, I did have dreams about bad things happening to me in the military, like showing up for a formation naked and somehow not noticing until I got there and getting in trouble for making mistakes. While I was in Iraq, I dreamed so convincingly that I was in Germany that I still thought I was in Germany when I woke up. It took me and my best friend a couple of minutes to get back to reality and realize that we were, in fact, in a crappy metal box trailer in the desert for another 12 months. Talk about a freight train of disappointment. I don't really dream about any of that stuff in my 30s, though. Heather.
So extinction of the dream obsession now.
Right. And elementary school stress dreams instead.
Weird. Sorry, I didn't mean to call you weird, Heather. I just mean the variety is interesting.
Now, on the pajamas in elementary school, I have an elementary like age memory. This wasn't going to school, but I, instead of taking my pajama pants off and putting pants on over them, I just put my blue jeans over my pajama pants and went on with my day, and then later discovered when I went to the restroom that I still had my pajamas on under my clothes. And that was a real life occurrence that kind of nicely mimics like the fears we have regarding you know, the kind of stress dreams that we have where we're like, you know, wearing our pajamas to school, wearing them out in the day.
Wait, were there any bad consequences to that?
Well, no, luckily not. But it's kind of, you know, it's like the adult version of realizing that you just drove for 4 hours there and back home and didn't have your driver's license. You're like, oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Like that, nothing went wrong. But what if it did? What if someone had noticed that I was wearing my pajamas all day underneath my pants as if this was just what I did?
That's a good comparison. All right. I think we're going to call the school dreams there. Sorry to the many, many of you who also got in touch with us with your great emails. We really appreciate them. But we got to go on to get some feedback about other episodes.
That's right. We can't just talk about dreams. We also have to talk about black holes.
That's right. So regarding our episodes about Sagittarius A star, the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, first of all, several listeners got in touch to ask us about the source of the opening monologue in that episode. I guess we didn't make it clear. They were asking if it was coming from a book or something. No, that was just us. That was just original to the show.
Yeah, if we're not sourcing it or citing it, then it's probably just something we made up.
Well, yes, that is generally the rule. We may have forgotten.
It's okay.
Unintentional. But yeah, since you asked, yeah, that's just us. So this first email comes from Chase. Chase writes, "Hey guys, I love your show. After listening to your series about Sagittarius A star, I thought of a way for me to conceptualize the astronomically large masses stated for black holes, and I wanted to share it with you." I thought this was pretty interesting. Chase says, "The black hole at the center of our Milky Way galaxy, Sagittarius A star, weighs in at 2.6 million solar masses. That's big, too big really for us humans to fully comprehend." I agree. So I did some math. If you think of the sun's mass as 1 second, Earth's mass is 3 microseconds, and Sagittarius A stars would be 30 days and 2 hours.
Oh, wow. That does really hammer it home.
But as we talked about in the episode, as huge as Sagittarius A star is from our perspective, the supermassive black holes at the center of other galaxies get much, much bigger. The quasar TUN 618 is one of the brightest objects in the known universe, so bright that the galaxy spinning around it is not visible from Earth because the quasar itself outshines it. The ultramassive black hole at the center of TUN 618 is the largest currently known. It is estimated to weigh 66 billion solar masses, and then by the same reckoning as earlier, where the sun's mass was 1 second, Earth's mass is 3 microseconds. This would be 2,097 years, 175 days if our sun is 1 second.
Wow. That's really good. I was hesitant when I started reading this email because I'm like, I'm not sure if they're going to pull this off. They're actually going to take these big numbers and put them in a, you know, use some sort of metaphor or transference that would really work. And this did. This totally did.
Time within historical records, I think, is a pretty good way for people to try to conceptualize big number analogies.
All right, here's another one concerning black holes. This one comes to us from Mike. Mike says, "Hi guys, just finished episode 2 on the supermassive black holes. Good stuff. In episode 1, you briefly mentioned musical references to black holes, but you missed one. I believe I've heard you mention the Canadian band Rush on past episodes, so I was surprised you missed mentioning their song dedicated to the first black hole to be experimentally discovered, Cygnus X1. Smiley face. Smiley face is not part of the black hole's name, though that would be amusing if it were. No, it's just Cygnus X1. Looking forward to hearing more about black holes on a future episode.
Now,
thanks, Mike.
I can't wait to find out about the first astronomical bodies that have emoji incorporated into their official names.
Yeah, that would be interesting. It's like we discover like Orpheus B3 eggplant emoji, you know, and I mean, yeah. I guess it's only a matter of time.
Earth will meet its demise with the impact of the great comet poop emoji. But Mike, thank you for bringing up Rush. Yes, I don't know about you, Robert. I'm a pretty big fan of Rush, especially. I'm not like one of those deep Rush maniacs who like knows all their catalog and all that, but Rush is one of my favorite things to come on classic rock radio. I always turn it up.
Wait, what is the Rush song I should know?
Tom Sawyer.
What's the other one I should know?
Let's not get night cheese.
What's the other one though?
There's Limelight. There's Closer to the Heart. There's what am I forgetting?
Maybe I just don't know Rush that well. I mean, I know I've heard them before. I've heard Tom Sawyer before, but I feel like there must be the one Rush song that resonates with me. And I'm not sure I'm recognizing it offhand.
His mind is not for rent to any god or government. You don't know this?
Oh, that one. I know that one.
Oh, that's Tom Sawyer.
Yeah. It's fine.
Oh, wait. There's also Spirit of the Radio. That's the one.
I don't know if I know that one.
I think they reference that sometimes on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Oh,
Salesman.
Yes. I don't think that's a riff I ever got, but I laughed at it, you know. All right, so any Rush fans out there, I guess I need some Rush education. So
write in and educate Robert.
Tell me what I need to listen to. Send me a playlist. I will give it a listen.
Bring him closer to the heart.
Speaking of coming closer to the heart and following up black holes, we have some listener mail concerning our episode on the One Ring.
Right. So this first one is a sort of correction that I take from our listener, Emmett. Now, this is because we were discussing the melting point of several different materials that were potential candidates to make a ring of power. You want to make a ring of power, what should you make it out of? And of course, mentioning the melting points is important because the one ring in the Lord of the Rings can't be melted by normal heat. It has to be, I think, could maybe be melted by dragon breath. I don't remember, but it had to be thrown into the fires of Mount Doom. Anyway, I mentioned graphene, the material, along with its melting point as a possible candidate. And Emmett got in touch to say, hey guys, in your One Ring episode, you discussed graphene as a potential material. If I'm not wrong, I'm pretty sure graphene will burn long before it melts, kind of like wood.
Oh, okay.
I looked this up. Yes, Emmett is exactly correct. I think it was rather silly of me to try to consider the melting point of graphene. I think that'd be sort of like considering the melting point of plywood. From what I can tell, you know, it even burns at a relatively low temperature in the presence of oxygen. So yeah, there is like – there's fire. There's combustion there. So very good point, Emmett. Thank you for clarifying that.
All right. We're scratching graphene off the list, off the official One Ring list.
I guess so.
All right. Here's another One Ring email. And this one comes to us from Sandy. Sandy writes in and says, dear Robert and Joe, first, I might have squealed a tiny bit when I saw the title of the episode. I love Tolkien and was so happy for this episode. And while I have a few corrections and notes, I mean, you hit nerddom, you know it's going to happen. I want to say I love the episode even when people looked at me funny on the tram when I spoke out loud in response several times. Oops, sorry, not sorry. First, regarding whether smog could have destroyed the One Ring, you actually answered it earlier in the show to quote Gandalf. It has been said that dragonfire could melt and consume the rings of power, but there is not now any dragon left on earth in which the old fire is hot enough, nor was there ever any dragon, not even Ancalagon the Black, who could have harmed the One Ring, the ruling ring, for that was made by Sauron himself. She continues, smog could have potentially destroyed the rings of power, the three, the seven, or the nine, but he could not have destroyed the One Ring. Even Ancalagon the Black could not have destroyed the One. Oh, and also Sandy throws in that it's very possible that Christopher Tolkien could have covered this particular item as well in his various publications. Anyway, they continue. Second, you almost failed to mention but did circle back to it, the issue of the ring's size, but then you erred. No shame. Part of the will of the ring, or rather part of it mirroring the will of its master, is its ability to change shape. This allows it to change bearers when it chooses. This is also why one of the names that the ring is known by is Isildur's Bane. Seek for the sword that was broken. In Imladris it dwells. There shall be counsels taken, stronger than Morgul spells. There shall be shown a token that doom is near at hand, for Isildur's bane shall waken, and the halfling forth shall stand. The poem from Faramir's recurring dream that Boromir then has once and which leads him to the Council of Elrond in Rivendell.
This all makes sense to me because I don't know if you mentioned after we did the episode, I was like, okay, I got to go back and just read it.
Oh, yeah, you picked it
so
up.
So I've been reading it. I'm in the middle of Two Towers right now.
Sandy continues, it's called that because the ring had come into Sildur's possession after he cut it off Sauron's finger in the War of the Last Alliance. He ignored counsel to destroy it, which suggests perhaps he could have in the immediate defeat and weakening of Sauron, maybe, probably not, especially if it's the ring that led to the orc ambush that resulted in his death. When he and the company he was with were ambushed by orcs, after a fierce battle with the orcs winning, he put it on his finger to escape, to keep the ring from falling in the wrong hands, and did so until the ring slipped off his finger. Most think that it did so intentionally, enlarging itself enough to slip off his finger, and he escaped and he escaped and was then killed by the orcs. This intentional slipping off of the finger may also be how it moved from Gollum to Bilbo. If Gollum had worn the ring, it had slipped off, and he had forgotten that he had worn it, he would expect it to be in its hiding place. Thus, when he returned to get it to ambush Bilbo after being bested in the contest of riddles, it was not there, as Bilbo had found it and slipped it into his pocket.
Right. So they're saying that the ring may be sort of like getting bigger and smaller when it wants to stick on somebody's finger or fall off somebody's finger in order to make it to a new host.
Right.
It's almost like a parasite of some kind. That has like attaching and detaching kind of properties, or like the way some parasites that are intestinal parasites will intentionally get themselves pooped out at some point in order to pass on to the next point in their life cycle. The ring kind of works that way.
But you know, Sandy's also touching on something which I could think could be a potential benefit of the ring, that we a power of the ring. Mm-hmm. So if you're like me and you have a ring that is kind of loose fitting, mm-hmm. you'll find that on cold days it is more likely to slide off. off. Mm-hmm. And on hot days, it is more it can be more difficult to remove.
Though it also has to do with things like, have you been walking around with your hands at your sides? Mm-hmm. Have you been drinking beer?
Yeah, there are all these factors that can affect the fit of a ring.
Uh-huh.
But if you have the One Ring, I'm guessing as long as it wants you, you're going to have a perfect fit at all times. And I think that's amazing. Excellent craftsmanship, Sauron.
Yeah, one of a kind.
All right, Sandy continues, almost done here. An interesting part of the ring that you did not mention was those that seem immune to its pull or able to resist it. We see both Galadriel and Gandalf refuse it, but they both also bear one of the three. And that is not to say that they were not tempted. However, we have two mortals, neither Elf nor Maia, and not protected by the three. The Nine, of course, bear no such protection for their wares as the bearers of the Nine or the Ringwraiths, Faramir and Sam. Sam even bears the ring with seemingly no temptation to do more than to carry the burden for Frodo. And one must wonder, how would things have been different if the brother not tempted by the ring had gone to Rivendell? Of course, Bombadil could literally play with the ring and see through its invisibility, but Bombadil is probably not exactly mortal. And yeah, I think Bombadil, by most interpretations, is far from mortal.
He's some kind of primal being.
Yeah, he's some sort of, yeah, a primal deity that is no longer really connected to the affairs of, I mean, he's connected to nature, I suppose, but not to the affairs of all these mortals and immortals battling for control of things.
Dude, we're really tunneled deep into Nerd Mountain here.
Okay. But did we tunnel too deep? I don't know. We'll find out. Anyway, Sandy finishes up. Anyway, I doubt this is the only way too long email about the wonderful Despite Its Errors episode. Thank you very much for doing it. Peace, Sandy.
Wait, I'm still not sure what exactly were the errors. I lost track in there. I think maybe we did not – we didn't get the thing about the dragon's breath.
No, well, I mean, I don't know. I don't think these were necessarily errors per se.
But they were, might be. I just literally aspects, lost track of them here.
I think that more Sandy was bringing up aspects of the mythology and extended mythology that we didn't really dwell on in the episode.
Sandy, I accept your wisdom. You are the master. You are clearly the lore master. You're the one who should have gone to Rivendell. we're the foolhardy Boromirs who barged ahead without having the wisdom and restraint.
No, but no, this is what I love about this topic is that there's so much room for ultimately for interpretation when you start trying to apply science to the scenario or really, you know, reach for the definitive answer on questions regarding, you know, the nature of the One Ring.
But okay, we've made it over the bridge of Khazad-dûm. We're now out of the nerd mines of Moria and into the daylight on the other side.
Woo! And yet we have more listener mail related to the One Ring, and this one comes to us from Tim.
Oh, wait. Okay. Yeah. So this one refers to another similar thing. So Tim writes, hey, Stuff to Blow Your Mind. I listened to your One Ring episode. First, I want to say, bold move. I bet you got an insane amount of listener mail for that one. Not as much mail as we got about school dreams, but we got some.
Right. Though I should also say we have an older email address that I don't think works anymore.
Uh-huh.
So if you're still using the How Stuff Works address to reach out for us, that's probably not going anywhere.
I don't know. We might still be getting
maybe
those or might not. I don't know what's arriving.
Yeah. Just as we're not entirely sure about how the One Ring functions, we're also not entirely sure how company email works.
Tim writes, at one point y'all mentioned a sci-fi version of Lord of the Rings. I thought you'd be interested in C.S. Lewis's space trilogy.
Mm.
Is it particularly good sci-fi? No. Is it a page-turner on par with Lord of the Rings? No siree. But does it specifically mention locations from Lord of the Rings, and was it made partially on a bet with Tolkien about trying to write sci-fi? Yes.
Huh.
Allegedly, both Tolkien and Lewis wanted to write science fiction because their contemporaries were writing atheistic science fiction. Both authors produced something. Lewis wrote the space trilogy and included themes from Tolkien. Tolkien wrote a strange, unfinished story that is marginally about Elrond time traveling.
Whoa.
You can read this oddity in one of the History of Middle-Earth books, I forget which. I don't suggest any of these works as good reads, but they're really neat when viewed in the context of both Tolkien and Lewis, and especially the theoretical combined Tolkien/Lewis legendarium. Anyways, great content. I couldn't ask for a better podcast to play in the background while I work. Thank you sincerely, Tim.
Yeah, I read the Space Trilogy years and years back. Like maybe it was even high school when I read. I think it was maybe high school when I read it initially. And then I reread, I think, Paralandra, the second one in college. Paralandra was my favorite of the three by far. And I think if I were to reread one today, it would definitely be Paralandra, which if you're not familiar with it, it recreates, I believe it's on Venus. Yes, because the first one is out of the silent planet, which is Mars, and Paralandra is Venus. And what's created is kind of an Eden world. It's a water planet. It's an Eden, and we have our character Ransom, a human, show up, and he's also arriving on the planet is this other character that is a human, but a human that is possessed by a demon. Mm-hmm. I believe it's basically Satan. Mm-hmm. So you have this whole sort of treatment of sin and evil in the world, and retelling of the fall of Eden in this strange, mythic kind of sci-fi setting. But it is, like you said, only marginally sci-fi. It ain't hard sci-fi at all. It's maybe soft sci-fi if we're going to get into the exact nougaty aspect of it here. But I remember digging it back in the day. I don't know how I'd feel about it today, but that's one reason to reread it.
I guess that goes to the question we dealt with, I think maybe in the last listener mail episode, about what is science fiction? Is it about humanity's challenges presented by new technology, or is it just like any stories that take place in the future, or stories that take place with space travel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't think that episode. I mean, that I don't think that installment was at all concerned with technology. Mm-hmm. I think it was inspired by sort of planet sci-fi of the of the olden days, and then was about Lewis exploring topics that Lewis was interested in.
Sword and planet stuff.
Yeah. Sword and planet, exactly. Now the third one is weird. That Hideous Strength.
I haven't read any of it.
I remembered having some like gender stuff in there that I probably would not really appreciate today. But I also remember there being some like real horror based stuff. Like as far as like horror in a C.S. Lewis book goes, there are some moments in that Hideous Strength that feel kind of creepy. Things with disembodied heads being made to speak and so forth.
It's been a long time, but I remember when I read the Narnia books, I remember there was a passage in Voyage of the Dawn Treader that I found really horrifying when I was a kid, at least. It was like when they go through this fog of fear or something. I don't know. Maybe I'll go back and revisit it, and it would seem rather tame today. All right, we need to take a break, but we'll be right back with more.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gaginianaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
All right, we're back. And this time we truly leave the worlds of Tolkien and Lewis behind, and we move on into more firmly scientific territory.
Okay, this is just a short message from Rasmus about our Electric Microbe Land episode. Hello, Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Just listened to the episode Electric Microbe Land, and I wanted to let you know how great it was. It was one of my favorite episodes ever. I think it brought up some very interesting concepts about electron transportation and respiration that I'd never heard of before, and I hope you will do more episodes on this topic. Best regards, Rasmus. Yeah, I'm not sure what the next thing on this subject area would be, but I'm game for more if you are, Robert. I guess
we just have to see what kind of studies and papers come out in the months ahead.
Yeah.
All right, we have another listener mail. This one concerns euphemisms, and this one, this was a vault episode, I believe.
Yes, it was.
So Thomas writes, the euphemism episode brought to mind a homework assignment I once had in primary school. We had to write a number of euphemisms, so being the smart aleck that I was, I thought I'd be hilarious to put making love is a euphemism for sexual intercourse. I think I was 9. I don't remember the reaction I got from my teacher. Joe mentioned that he loves idioms from around the world. So down here in New Zealand, and maybe Australia too, we say, we're not here to f*** spiders, which basically translates as we're not here to waste time.
I love this expression. That is so good.
I live in Canada now and once said this and got a resounding look of confusion. Love both your shows and think it could be interesting to hear invention shows on plastic and knives. Recently been watching Bob Kramer knife-making videos. Keep up the good work.
Knife-making videos can be very hypnotic.
Now, I don't want to speak too much about invention on a listener mail for Stuff to Blow Your Mind because we do our own invention listener mails as well. But knives could be interesting, not so much in terms of pinpointing like where knives were invented and that sort of thing, but maybe looking at the sort of innovations that have taken place over time, like how knives have changed and what different purposes we use knives for.
Yeah, that'd be a huge, very complex story, probably a multi-parter, right? Because what would you have to start with the hand axe going back to our Dietrich Stout interview?
You probably have to start with pre-knife stone tools
the
and the like.
Yeah.
But then you can get into some really fun stuff like the switchblade.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Off the top of my head, I have no idea exactly how the switchblade comes into being, but it is such an iconic knife. It's the bad guy knife, you know?
Robert, we're not here to f*** spiders.
To say nothing of the Swiss Army knife. Now I'm even more convinced. I'm very interested in chasing these various weird knives through history.
All right. This next email about euphemisms was very short, but I wanted to read it because I thought it was funny. This is just part of an email we got from our listener, Anna. Anna says she just listened to our Vault episode about euphemisms. And writes, a bad example of a euphemism is when I worked full-time for a software company. The company was not doing very well, so they had to decrease everyone to 4 days a week. They described this as, quote, increasing your work-life balance.
Oh, my God. That is some of the worst corporate BS speak that I've encountered.
Really good.
All right, this one, next one comes to us from Roger. Roger says, hey guys, been a fan of Stuff to Blow Your Mind for a long time and really enjoy your new show, Invention, as well. Having to drive 1 hour to get to work each day gives me plenty of time to listen to your podcasts to make the drive more enjoyable, and I try to catch every episode. Being a Norwegian myself, it was interesting to hear that the Norwegian phrase, Ugler I Mosen, owls in the moss, had reached you. As you found the phrase somewhat amusing, I thought I'd shed some more light on it, especially since the phrase falls in line with how languages change, as you mentioned regarding the euphemism treadmill example in your euphemisms episode. The phrase, as you mentioned, means something is afoot or something is not how it should be. Another way of putting it is to be wary or be careful. The term actually originates from Denmark. However, in Danish, the term was der er uller emusen. Now, this term has a different meaning in Danish and actually means there are wolves in the swamp or marsh.
That makes a lot more sense for something being afoot.
The difference here, of course, is that the Danes used uller, wolves, rather than ugler, owls. And in Danish, the word mosen means swamps or marshes, wetlands, while the same word mosen in Norwegian means moss. The Danish term was primarily used with regards to the cattle trade to imply a shady trade up until the end of the 1800s. And after the wolves were eradicated from Denmark, the term gradually changed from uller, wolves, to ugler, owls, and has since kept that meaning. Another fun thing to remark about this is also that the term has yet again changed a little. When something is shady or there is something afoot, and we have a single word in Norwegian which encapsulates the whole meaning, and that is muffins.
Muffins. So it's like instead of saying something shady is going on, you can just say muffins.
Yeah, you would say det no muffins. That would mean, they say, there is something shady going on here. These days, you will sometimes hear people say, det muffins I mosen, meaning there is something shady in the moss. And this has yet again, sometimes deliberately to be funny, and other times simply as a misquote, been changed to det muffins I mosen, which means there are muffins in the moss. You could argue that muffins in the moss also implies that something is not right or that there is something afoot. So while the phrase has been changed around, it still retains its original meaning, at least to some extent. Though it has moved quite a bit from its original and foreboding message, there are wolves in the marshes, to the more benign, there are muffins in the moss. Thought this might be a fun little exploration into how language changes over time using a foreign phrase you brought up in your podcast. Also, big thanks to both of your podcasts, which keep me entertained, always allows me to pick up and learn new things, as well as how you frequently come at various topics from unexpected angles and often makes me go, I never thought of it that way, while on my way to or from work. Keep up the great work and looking forward to the next episodes of both Invention and Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
Well, thank you so much, Roger. That was fantastically interesting and funny. We had heard from several other listeners about the owls in the moss expression. You're not the only one to get in touch about that. But this is the only place I think I heard about muffins.
Yeah, I really like this muffins in the moss talk. I want to start incorporating that into my into my daily discourse.
Right. But Robert, we're not here to f*** muffins in the moss.
You're really getting a lot out of Carney's new profanity bleeping software, Joe. You're really putting it to the test here.
We keep it clean around here. All right. Finally, I think we're going to read something about the Voynich manuscript episodes we did. So this comes from Matt. Matt says, "Hey, guys, longtime listener, first time correspondent. Absolutely love the show, along with Invention, stuff you should know and stuff they don't want you to know. I've had a high-res PDF of the Voynich manuscript for a while, and I've used it in my own artwork as well as in D&D campaigns as inspiration." Man, we are just hearing from so many D&D people.
Yeah, I love it. The more dungeon masters and game masters we have listening to the show, the better.
Matt goes on, "The drawings are somewhat sloppy, but very endearing. The text is immaculate and fascinating, at least aesthetically. My theory is simple. It's an art book, not intended to deceive or prank anyone, just a cool project of someone similar to me, to be honest. A few things I notice is that it looks like the drawings were done first and the text added after. Pretty obvious. I also think it was written from right to left, not left to right. Could be the creator or creators was left-handed. I am left-handed, and I find writing that way is quite easy, especially if I'm 100% making it up as I go. It also drastically reduces smudging. I took bookmaking and book restoring classes in art school, and I made a few occult tomes for fun or as class projects. Never sold them, still have them some 20-plus years later. One is even on antique paper I found, which brings me to another theory I read. Not sure if you covered it. Maybe the text, art, and paper itself are all of different ages or even by different people. Anyway, keep up the fascinating work. And I have a long back catalog of you guys to eventually listen to, which I love. It would be sad if there were only 50 or so podcasts so far. Thank you for reading, Matt." And then Matt attached a page for us to look at from one of his Voynich-esque art books. It looks like a combination of some strange architectural plans with some kind of like Tool album cover body art.
Yeah, kind of a Leonardo da Vinci aspect to it as well.
Yeah, I like this.
You know, speaking of, I would love to come back and do something on Leonardo da Vinci proper, because I was listening to Ideas on CBC radio.
Mm-hmm. Paul Kennedy, yeah.
Well, Paul has moved on now. Yeah. I mean, he's retired, and there's a new host, but it's still a great show. And they did one recently on Leonardo da Vinci's use of monsters.
Ooh.
And his like lifelong obsession with monsters. And it was quite fascinating, obviously, because it touches on several different things that I really enjoy. So I would recommend anyone out there, if you want to check out Ideas, you've heard me talk about it for years. If you're interested in monsters and or Leonardo da Vinci, go find that episode.
I am tremendously intrigued. There are spikes shooting out of my brain about this.
All right. I have another Voynich manuscript, a bit of listener mail to read here. This one comes to us from David. David writes, "I was just finishing your episodes on the Voynich manuscript, and I wanted to see if what I started to suspect had already been offered as a theory. One of you mentioned that sigils and proto-cryptograms you would create as a child. I had already begun to suspect, almost as quickly as I started listening to the episodes, the possibility that it is the work of a child." This could explain a few things: the nonsensical language, but close enoughness of the language, the unrecognizable drawings, even the drawings of naked women, a prime curiosity for male children. If you think about the nature of manuscripts of the time, access to the material was reserved for either the clergy or the very wealthy. The idea of a child more or less rules out the clergy, but it wouldn't be an extreme stretch of the imagination that a wealthy lord or baron could allocate resources for the pet project of their preferred son. I say son because it's the most logical choice for the time and place, and privileged people believing that their children are somehow preternaturally intelligent is nothing new and also never going to go out of style. The product of the kinds of pressure that children like these experience do often exhibit a sophistication beyond their years, which could explain the nature of the drawing and the writing. This is just an idea, and it wouldn't surprise me if somebody else had already come up with it. I'm not claiming to have cracked it. I've never even looked at it.
Okay.
Because if it is the work of a child's mind, then there's nothing to crack. It's just adults trying to decipher meanings from the musings of a child, which would be equally frustrating and hilarious to think about all the wasted time and conspiracy. And at the end of the day, the answers to many riddles are hiding in plain sight. It's only when we try to read into them and overanalyze them that they become misconstrued. Thanks for your time, both for reading and the work you put into your shows. Cheers, David." Now, this is really interesting. I really like this idea of looking at it as potentially as the work of a child, you know, in part because that could potentially, it seems like it could maybe be one of the possibilities. But more importantly, I like the idea of then learned adults coming to it and overanalyzing it and finding it so intriguing. Adults who, you know, no longer have that pure childhood curiosity, that pure plasticity of a young child. But in doing so, it's kind of like, you know, the whole idea of children say the darndest things or whatever, you know, like children will say weirdly crazy and often illogical things that just fill us with laughter and sometimes awe, you know, sometimes they cut to like a truth of the universe that we would never, you know, we would never quite say it that way, but a child has. We would never draw it that way, but a child did. So, I like this idea. As the father of a child who loves to illustrate strange books about dinosaurs, you know, I'll look at them and I'll be like, that is crazy. I love it. And, yeah, I can imagine something like that taking place with the Vonage manuscript, whether or not it's actually a valid theory or not.
Totally. One last thing I will say about the Voynich manuscript is that several listeners got in touch to ask us about a particular theory explaining it that has been in a couple of videos online. I believe it's with some scholars saying they believe it's in some archaic form of Turkish or has something to do with like a Turkish culture that created the manuscript. Basically, like I've looked at it, I looked at the videos. I have no way of evaluating it because I don't have, you know, expertise in cryptography or Turkish or medieval manuscripts or – and I guess not medieval or Renaissance manuscripts. So I don't know, but I also haven't found anything by experts evaluating this theory. So that already makes me a little cautious about saying, yes, they cracked it, as, you know, we tended to be with all kinds of things. But it's possible. Yeah, I'd be curious to hear what the scholars and relevant experts say.
Well, the folks at Yale would be the ones to ask. They would be.
At the – how do you – the Beinecke Library or however you say it.
Beinecke, I think.
Beinecke.
Yeah.
Beinecke. I think we said it wrong at least once in the episode.
One of us is right or we're both wrong. but I feel like we have pretty good odds there. Whew, well, I don't know about you, Joe, but I feel like I'm out of steam for this week's listener mail.
Yes, I would say there are owls in the moss because they've lost the will to fly and fully collapsed into the underbrush.
All right. So, yeah, we're going to go ahead and close the mailbox for now. Again, we read everything. We don't get to read everything on the show and we don't get to write back, but we do continue to enjoy hearing from everyone. You know, you end up adding so much additional insight into the topics we discuss. And we just love to know as well, you know, what is really resonating with you, what kind of topics that you dig, and what kind of topics you want us to do in the future. In the meantime, if you want to listen to more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you'll find them at stufftoblowyourmind.com, and you'll find the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. The best thing you can do to support the show is to tell other people about it and to rate and review wherever you have the power to do so. The same goes for Invention, our show that goes through human techno history, one invention at a time. Inventionpod.com is the website, but you'll find it all over the place. And if you want a little slice of sci-fi fiction horror this holiday season as you're driving around or flying around or just staying put, check out Second Oil Age. That's the show that I worked on. And as of this publication, I think most of the episodes are up. Maybe it has like two more. All the episodes will be up by the end of November, and then you can binge it.
If you haven't listened to the Second Oil Age yet, really do check it out. I think you will love it. If you're a fan of this show, it should be right up your alley.
All right. Well, thanks to Carney for helping us out once more.
Of course, thanks as always to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you'd like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to just send some general listener mail that could be featured on a future episode like this one, you can, as always, email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.